Such torrents couldn't have risen just since the storm had swept across the plains minutes ago. The runoff was from the mountains, where rain had been falling for a while, and where the stony, treeless slopes absorbed little of it. The desert seldom received downpours of that magnitude, but on rare occasions, with breathtaking suddenness, flash floods could inundate even portions of the elevated interstate highway, or pour into low-lying areas of the now distant Las Vegas Strip and sweep cars out of casino parking lots. Spencer couldn't judge the depth of the water. It might have been 2 feet or 20. Even if only 2 feet deep, the water was moving so fast, with such power, that he didn't dare attempt to ford it. The second wash was wider than the first, 40 feet across. Before he traveled half that distance, the truck would be lifted and carried downriver, rolling and bobbing as if it were driftwood. He backed the explorer away from the churning flow, turned, and retraced his route, arriving at the first arroyo to the south more quickly than he expected. In the brief time since he had crossed it, the silvery freshet had become a turbulent river that nearly filled the wash. Bracketed by impassable cataracts, Spencer was no longer able to parallel the distant north-south interstate. He considered parking right there to wait for the storm to pass. When the rain ended, the arroyos would empty as swiftly as they had filled, but he sensed that the situation was more dangerous than it appeared. He opened the door, stepped into the downpour, and was soaked by the time he had walked to the front of the explorer. The pummeling rain hammered a chill deep into his flesh. The cold and the wet contributed to his misery less than did the incredible noise. The oppressive roar of the storm blocked all other sounds. The rattle of the rain against the desert, the swash and rumble of the river, and the booming thunder combined to make the vast Mojave as confining and claustrophobia-inducing as the interior of a stuntman's barrel on the brink of Niagara. He wanted a better view of the surging flux than he'd gotten from inside the truck, but a closer look alarmed him. Moment by moment, water lapped higher on the banks of the wash. Soon it would flood across the plain. Sections of the soft arroyo walls collapsed, dissolving into muddy currents, and were carried away. Even as the violent gush eroded a wider channel, it swelled tremendously in volume, simultaneously rising and growing broader. Spencer turned from the first arroyo and hurried toward the second, to the south of the truck. He reached that other impromptu river sooner than he expected. It was brimming and widening like the first channel. 50 yards had separated the two arroyos when he'd first driven between them, but that gap had shrunk to 30. 30 yards was still a considerable distance. He found it difficult to believe that those two spates were powerful enough to eat through so much remaining land and ultimately converge. Then, immediately in front of his shoes, a crack opened in the ground, a long, jagged leer. The earth grinned, and a 6-foot-wide slab of riverbank collapsed into the onrushing water. Spencer stumbled backward out of immediate danger. The sodden land around him was turning mushy underfoot. The unthinkable suddenly seemed inevitable. Large portions of the desert were all shale and volcanic rocks and quartzite, but he had the misfortune to be caught in a cloudburst while traveling over a fathomless sea of sand. Unless a hidden spine of rock was buried between the two arroyos, the intervening land might indeed be washed away and the entire plain recontoured, depending on how long the storm raged at its current intensity. The impossibly heavy downfall abruptly grew heavier still. He sprinted for the explorer, clambered inside, and pulled his door shut. Shivering, streaming water, he backed the truck further from the northern arroyo, afraid that the wheels would be undermined. With head still downcast from under his lowered brow, Rocky looked up worriedly at his master. "Have to drive between arroyos east to west," Spencer thought aloud, "while there's still something to drive on." The windshield wipers weren't coping well with the cascades that poured across the glass, and the rain-blurred landscape settled into deeper degrees of false twilight. He tried turning the wiper control to a higher setting. It was already as high as it would go. "Shouldn't head toward lower land. Water's gaining velocity as it goes. More likely to wash out down there." He switched the headlamps to high beams. The extra light didn't clarify anything. It bounced off the skeins of rain, so the way ahead seemed to be obscured by curtain after curtain of mirrored beads. He selected the low beams again. "Safer ground uphill. Ought to be more rock." The dog only trembled. "The space between arroyos will probably widen out." Spencer shifted gears again. The plain sloped gradually up to the west, into obscure terrain. As giant needles of lightning stitched the heavens to the earth, he drove into the resultant narrow pocket of gloom. At Roy Miro's direction, agents in San Francisco were seeking Ethel and George Porth, the maternal grandparents who had raised Spencer Grant following the death of his mother. Meanwhile, Roy drove to the offices of Dr. Nero Mondello in Beverly Hills. Mandela was the most prominent plastic surgeon in a community where God's work was revised more frequently than anywhere except Palm Springs and Palm Beach. On a misshapen nose, he could perform miracles equivalent to those that Michelangelo had performed on giant cubes of Carrara marble, though Mandela's fees were substantially higher than those of the Italian master. He had agreed to make changes in a busy schedule to meet with Roy because he believed that he was assisting the FBI in a desperate search for a particularly savage serial killer. They met in the doctor's spacious inner office, white marble floor, white walls and ceiling, white shell sconces. Two abstract paintings hung in white frames. The only color was white, and the artist achieved his effects solely with the textures of the heavily layered pigment. Two whitewashed lacewood chairs with white leather cushions flanked a glass and steel table and stood before a whitewashed burled wood desk against a backdrop of white silk draperies. Roy sat in one of the lacewood chairs like a blot of soil in all that whiteness, and wondered what view would be revealed if the draperies were opened. He had the crazy notion that beyond the window in downtown Beverly Hills lay a landscape swaddled in snow. Other than the photographs of Spencer Grant that Roy had brought with him, the only object on the polished surface of the desk was a single blood-red rose in a Waterford cut-crystal vase. The flower was a testament to the possibility of perfection, and drew the visitor's attention to the man who sat beyond it, behind the desk. Tall, slender, handsome, 40-ish, Dr. Nero Mandela was the focal point of his bleached domain. With his thick, jet-black hair combed back from his forehead, warm-toned olive complexion, and eyes the precise purple-black of ripe plums, the surgeon had an impact almost as powerful as that of a spirit manifestation. He wore a white lab coat over a white shirt and red silk necktie. Around the face of his gold Rolex, matched diamonds sparkled as though charged with supernatural energy. The room and the man were no less impressive for being blatantly theatrical. Mandela was in the business of replacing nature's truth with convincing illusions, and all good magicians were theatrical. Studying the DMV photograph of Grant and the computer-generated portrait, Mandela said, "Yes, this would have been a dreadful wound, quite terrible." "What might have caused it?" Roy asked. Mandela opened a desk drawer and removed a magnifying glass with a silver handle. He studied the photographs more closely. At last he said, "It was more a cut than a tear, so it must have been a relatively sharp instrument."
"A knife?"
"Or glass, but it wasn't an entirely even cutting edge. Very sharp, but slightly irregular, like glass or a serrated blade. An even blade would have produced a cleaner wound and a narrower scar."
Watching Mandela pore over the photographs, Roy realized that the surgeon's facial features were so refined and so uncannily well-proportioned that a talented colleague had been at work on them.
"It's a cicatricial scar."
"Excuse me?" Roy said.
"Connective tissue that's contracted, pinched, or wrinkled,"
Mandela said, without looking up from the photographs.
"Though this one is relatively smooth, considering its width."
He returned the magnifying glass to the drawer.
"I can't tell you much more, except that it's not a recent scar."
"Could surgery eliminate it? Skin grafts?"
"Not entirely, but it could be made far less visible, just a thin line, a thread of discoloration."
"Painful?" Roy asked.
"Yes, but this," he tapped the photo, "wouldn't require a long series of surgeries over a number of years, as burns might."
Mandela's face was exceptional because the proportions were so studied, as though the guiding aesthetic behind his surgery had been not merely the intuition of an artist, but the logical rigor of a mathematician. The doctor had remade himself with the same iron control that great politicians applied to society to transform its imperfect citizens into better people. Roy had long understood that human beings were so deeply flawed that no society could have perfect justice without imposing mathematically rigorous planning and stern guidance from the top. Yet he'd never perceived, until now, that his passion for ideal beauty and his desire for justice were both aspects of the same longing for utopia. Sometimes Roy was amazed by his intellectual complexity. "Why," he asked Mandela, "would a man live with that scar if it could be made all but invisible, aside, that is, from being unable to pay for the surgery?"
"Oh, cost wouldn't be a deterrent. If the patient had no money and the government wouldn't pay, he'd still receive treatment. Most surgeons have always dedicated a portion of their professional time to charity work like this."
"Then why?"
Mandela shrugged and pushed the photographs across the desk.
Perhaps he's afraid of pain.
I don't think so, not this man.
Or afraid of doctors, hospitals, sharp instruments, anesthesia. There are countless phobias that prevent people from having surgery.
This man's not a phobic personality, Roy said, returning the photos to the manila envelope.
Could be guilt. If he lived through an accident in which others were killed, he could have survivor's guilt, especially if loved ones died. He feels he's no better than they were, and he wonders why he was spared when they were taken. He feels guilty just for living. Suffering with the scar is a way of atoning.
Frowning, Roy got to his feet. Maybe.
I've had patients with that problem. They don't want surgery because survivor's guilt led them to feel they deserved their scars.
That doesn't sound right either, not for this guy.
If he's not either phobic or suffering from survivor's guilt, said Mondello, coming around the desk and walking Roy to the door, then you can bet it's guilt over something. He's punishing himself with the scar, reminding himself of something he would like to forget but feels obligated to remember. I've seen that before as well.
As the surgeon talked, Roy studied his face, fascinated by the finely honed bone structure. He wondered how much of the effect had been achieved with real bone and how much with plastic implants, but he knew it would be gauche to ask. At the door, he said, Doctor, do you believe in perfection? Pausing with his hand on the doorknob, Mondello appeared mildly puzzled.
Perfection?
Personal and societal perfection, a better world.
Well, I believe in always striving for it.
Good, Roy smiled. I knew you did.
But I don't believe it can be achieved.
Roy's smile froze. Oh, but I've seen perfection now and then. Not perfection in the whole of anything, perhaps, but in part.
Mondello smiled indulgently and shook his head. One man's idea of perfect order is another man's chaos. One man's vision of perfect beauty is another man's notion of deformity. Roy did not appreciate such talk. The implication was that any utopia was also hell. Eager to convince Mondello of an alternate view, he said,
Perfect beauty exists in nature.
No, there's always a flaw. Nature abhors symmetry, smoothness, straight lines, order, all the things we associate with beauty.
I recently saw a woman with perfect hands, flawless hands, without a blemish, exquisitely shaped.
A cosmetic surgeon looks at the human form with a more critical eye than other people do. I'd have seen a lot of flaws, I'm sure.
The doctor's smugness irritated Roy, and he said, I wish I'd brought those hands to you, the one, anyway. If I'd brought it, if you'd seen it, you would have agreed. Suddenly Roy realized that he had come close to revealing things that would have necessitated the surgeon's immediate execution. Concerned that his agitated state of mind would lead him to make another and more egregious error, Roy dawdled no longer. He thanked Mondello for his cooperation, and he got out of the white room. In the medical building parking lot, the February sunshine was more white than golden, with a harsh edge, and a border of palm trees cast eastward-leaning shadows. The afternoon was turning cool. As he twisted the key in the ignition and started the car, his pager beeped. He checked the small display window, saw a number with a prefix of the regional offices in downtown Los Angeles, and made the call on his cellular phone. They had big news for him. Spencer Grant had almost been chased down in Las Vegas. He was now on the run, overland across the Mojave Desert. A Learjet was standing by at LAX to take Roy to Nevada. Driving up the barely perceptible slope between two rushing rivers, on a steadily narrowing peninsula of sodden sand, searching for an intruding formation of rock on which to batten down and wait out the storm, Spencer was hampered by decreasing visibility. The clouds were so thick, so black, that daylight on the desert was as murky as that a few fathoms under any sea. Rain fell in biblical quantities, overwhelming the windshield wipers, and although the headlights were on, clear glimpses of the ground ahead were brief. Great fiery lashes tortured the sky. The blinding pyrotechnics escalated into nearly continuous chain lightning, and brilliant links rattled down the heavens as though an evil angel imprisoned in the storm were angrily testing his bonds. Even then, the inconstant light illuminated nothing, while swarms of stroboscopic shadows flickered across the landscape, adding to the gloom and confusion. Suddenly, ahead and a quarter mile to the west, at ground level, a blue light appeared as if from out of another dimension. At once it moved off to the south at high speed. Spencer squinted through rain and shadow, trying to discern the nature and size of the light source. The details remained obscure. The blue traveler turned east, proceeded a few hundred yards, then swung north toward the explorer, spherical, incandescent.
What the hell?
Spencer slowed the explorer to a crawl to watch the eerie luminosity. When it was still 100 yards from him, the thing swerved west toward the place where it had first appeared, then dwindled past that point, rose, flared, and vanished. Even before the first light winked out, Spencer saw a second from the corner of his eye. He stopped and looked west-northwest. The new object, blue, throbbing, moved incredibly fast on an erratic serpentine course that brought it closer before it angled east. Abruptly, it spun like pinwheel fireworks and disappeared. Both objects had been silent, gliding like apparitions across the storm-washed desert. The skin prickled on his arms and along the nape of his neck. For the past few days, although he was usually skeptical of all things mystical, he had felt that he was venturing into the unknown, the uncanny. In his country, in his time, real life had become a dark fantasy, as full of sorcery as any novel about lands where wizards ruled, dragons roamed, and trolls ate children. Wednesday night, he had stepped through an invisible doorway that separated his lifelong reality from another place. In this new reality, Valerie was his destiny. Once found, she would be a magic lens that would forever alter his vision. All that was mysterious would become clear, but things long known and understood would become mysterious once more. He felt all that in his bones, as an arthritic man might feel the approach of a storm before the first cloud crossed the horizon. He felt more than understood it, and the visitations of the two blue spheres seemed to confirm that he was on the right trail to find Valerie, traveling to a strange place that would transform him. He glanced at his four-legged companion, hoping that Rocky was staring toward where the second light had vanished. He needed confirmation that he had not imagined the thing, even if his only reassurance came from a dog. But Rocky was huddled and shivering in terror. His head remained bowed, and his eyes were downcast. To the right of the explorer, lightning was reflected in raging water. The river was much closer than he expected. The right-hand arroyo had widened dramatically in the past minute. Hunched over the wheel, he angled to the new midpoint of the ever-narrowing strip of high ground and drove forward, seeking stable rock, wondering if the mysterious Mojave had more surprises for him. The third blue enigma plunged out of the sky as fast and plumb as an express elevator, 200 yards ahead and to the left. It halted smoothly and hovered just above the ground, revolving rapidly. Spencer's heart thudded painfully against his ribs. He eased off the accelerator. He was balanced between wonder and dread. The glowing object shot straight at him, as large as the truck, still without detail, silent, otherworldly, on a collision course. He tramped the accelerator. The light swerved to counter his move, swelled brighter, filled the explorer with blue-blue light. To make a smaller target of himself, he turned right, braked hard, putting the back end of the truck to the oncoming object. It struck without force, but with sprays of sapphire sparks and scores of electrical arcs blazed from one prominent point of the truck to another. Spencer was encapsulated in a dazzling blue sphere of hissing, crackling light, and knew what it was. One of the rarest of all weather phenomena, ball lightning. It wasn't a conscious entity, not the extraterrestrial force he had half imagined, neither stalking nor seducing him. It was simply one more element of the storm, as impersonal as ordinary lightning, thunder, rain. Perched on four tires, the explorer was safe. As soon as the ball burst upon them, its energy began to dissipate. Sizzling and snapping, it swiftly faded to a fainter blue, dimmer, dimmer. His heart had been pounding with a strange jubilation, as though he desperately wanted to encounter something paranormal, even if it proved hostile, rather than return to a life without wonder. Though rare, ball lightning was too mundane to satisfy his expectations, and disappointment brought his heart rate almost back to normal. With a jolt, the front of the truck dropped precipitously, and the cab tipped forward. As a final arc of electricity crackled from the left headlight rim to the top right corner of the windshield frame, dirty water sloshed over the hood. In his panic, as he had tried to avoid the blue light, Spencer had swung too far to the right, braking at the brink of the arroyo. The soft wall of sand was eroding beneath him. His heart raced again, his disappointment forgotten. He shifted into reverse and eased down on the accelerator. The truck moved backward up the disintegrating slope. Another slab of bank gave way. The explorer tipped farther forward. Water surged across the hood, almost to the windshield. Spencer abandoned caution, accelerated hard. The truck jumped backward, out of the water, tires eating through the soft, wet ground, tipping back, back, almost horizontal again. The arroyo wall was too unstable to endure. The churning wheels destabilized the gelatinous ground. Engine shrieking, tires spinning in the treacherous muck, the explorer slid into the flood, protesting as noisily as a mastodon being sucked into a tar pit. Son of a bitch! Spencer inhaled deeply and held his breath as though he were a schoolboy leaping into a pond. The truck splashed beneath the surface, fully submerged. Unnerved by the calamitous sound and motion, Rocky wailed in misery, as though responding not only to current events but to the cumulative terrors of his entire troubled life. The explorer broke the surface, wallowing like a boat in rough seas. The windows were closed, preventing an inrush of cold water, but the engine had gone dead. The truck was swept downstream, pitching and yawing, riding higher in the flood than Spencer had expected. The choppy surface lapped 4 to 6 inches below the sill of his side window. He was assaulted by liquid noises, a symphonic Chinese water torture, the hollow paradiddle of rain on the roof, the whoosh and swish and plash and gurgle of the churning flow against the explorer. Above all the competing sounds, a drizzling noise drew Spencer's attention because it was intimate, not muffled by sheet metal or glass. The maracas of a rattlesnake wouldn't have been more alarming. Somewhere, water was getting into the truck. The breach wasn't catastrophic, a drizzle, not a gush. With every pound of water taken aboard, however, the truck would ride lower until it sank. Then it would tumble along the river bottom, pushed rather than buoyed, body crumpling, windows shattering. Both front doors were secure, no leaks. As the truck heaved and plunged downstream, Spencer turned in his seat, snared by his safety harness, and examined the cargo hold. All windows were intact. The tailgate wasn't leaking. The back seat was folded down so he couldn't see the floor concealed under it, but he doubted that the river was getting through the rear doors either. When he faced front again, his feet sloshed in an inch of water. Rocky whined, and Spencer said, "It's okay. Don't alarm the dog. Don't lie, but don't alarm." Heater. The engine was dead, but the heater still functioned. The river was invading through the lower vents. Spencer switched off the system, closed the air intakes. The drizzle was silenced. As the truck pitched, the headlights slashed the bruised sky and glistered in the mortal torrents of rain. Then the truck yawed, and the beams cut wildly left and right, seeming to carve the arroyo walls. Slabs of earth crashed into the dirty tide, spewing gouts of pearlescent foam. He killed the lights, and the resultant gray-on-gray world was less chaotic. The windshield wipers were running on battery power. He didn't switch them off. He needed to see what was coming as best he could. He would be less stressed and no worse off if he lowered his head and closed his eyes like Rocky and waited for fate to deal with him as it wished. A week ago, he might have done that. Now he peered forward anxiously, hands locked to the useless steering wheel. He was surprised by the fierceness of his desire to survive. Until he had walked into the red door, he had expected nothing from life, only to keep a degree of dignity and to die without shame. Blackened tumbleweed, thorny limbs of uprooted cacti, masses of desert bunch grass that might have been the blonde hair of drowned women, and pale driftwood rode the rolling river with the explorer, scraping and thumping against it. In emotional turmoil equal to the tumult of the natural world, Spencer knew that he had been traveling the years as if he himself were driftwood. But at last he was alive. The water course abruptly dropped 10 or 12 feet, and the truck sailed over a roaring cataract, airborne, tipping forward. It dove into the rampaging water, into a diluvial darkness. Spencer was first jerked forward in his harness, then slammed backward. His head bounced off the headrest. The explorer failed to hit bottom, exploded through the surface, and rollicked on downriver. Rocky was still on the passenger seat, huddled and miserable, claws hooked in the upholstery. Spencer gently stroked and squeezed the back of the mutt's neck. Rocky didn't raise his bowed head, but turned toward his master and rolled his eyes to look up from under his brow. Interstate 15 was a quarter mile ahead. Spencer was stunned that the truck had been carried so far in so little time. The currents were even faster than they seemed. The highway spanned the arroyo, usually a dry wash, on massive concrete columns. Through the smeary windshield and heavy rain, the bridge supports appeared to be absurdly numerous, as if government engineers had designed the structure primarily to funnel millions of dollars to a senator's nephew in the concrete business. The central passage between the bridge supports was broad enough to let 5 trucks pass abreast, but half the flood churned through the narrower races between the closely ranked columns on each side of the main channel. Impact with the bridge supports would be deadly. Swooping, plunging, they rode a series of rapids. Water splashed against the windows. The river picked up speed, a lot of speed. Rocky was shaking more violently than ever and panting raggedly. "Easy, pal, easy. You better not pee on the seat, you hear?" On I-15, the headlights of big rigs and cars moved through the storm-darkened day.
Emergency flashers threw red light into the rain where motorists had stopped on the shoulder to wait out the downpour. The bridge loomed, exploding ceaselessly against the concrete columns. The river threw sheets of spray into the rain-choked air. The truck had attained a fearful velocity, shooting downstream. It rolled violently, and waves of nausea swelled through Spencer. "Better not pee on the seat," he repeated, no longer speaking only to the dog. He reached under his fleece-lined denim jacket, under his soaked shirt, and withdrew the jade-green soapstone medallion that hung on a gold chain around his neck. On one side was the carved head of a dragon. On the other side was an equally stylized pheasant. Spencer vividly recalled the elegant windowless office beneath China Dream, Louis Lee's smile, the bow tie, suspenders, the gentle voice. "I sometimes give one of these to people who seem to need it." Without slipping the chain over his head, he held the medallion in one hand. He felt childish, but he held it tightly nonetheless. The bridge was 50 yards ahead. The explorer was going to pass dangerously close to the forest of columns on the right. Pheasants and dragons, prosperity and long life. He remembered the statue of Kuan Yin by the front door of the restaurant, serene but vigilant, guarding against envious people. "After a life like yours, you can believe in this?"
"We must believe in something, Mr. Grant."
10 yards from the bridge, ferocious currents caught the truck, lifted it, dropped it, tipped it half onto its right side, rolled it back to the left, and slapped loudly against the doors. Sailing out of the storm into the eclipsing shadow of the highway above, they passed the first of the bridge columns in the row immediately to the right, past the second at horrendous speed. The river was so high that the solid underside of the bridge was only a foot above the truck. They surged nearer to the columns, bulleting past the third, the fourth, nearer still. Pheasants and dragons, pheasants and dragons. The currents pulled the truck away from the concrete supports and dropped it into a sudden swale in the turbulent surface, where it wallowed with filthy water to its windowsills. The river teased Spencer with the possibility of safe passage in that trough, pushing them along as if they were on a bobsled in a luge chute. But then it mocked his brief flicker of hope by lifting the truck again and tossing it passenger side first into the next column. The crash was as loud as a bomb blast. Metal shrieked and Rocky howled. The impact pitched Spencer to his left, a move that the safety harness couldn't check. The side of his head slammed into the window. In spite of all the other clamor, he heard the tempered glass webbing with a million hairline cracks, a sound like a crisp slice of toast being crushed with a sudden clench of a fist. Cursing, he put his left hand to the side of his head. No blood, only a rapid throbbing that was in time with his heartbeat. The window was a mosaic of thousands of tiny chips of glass held together by the gummy film in the center of the sandwiched pane. Miraculously, the windows on Rocky's side were undamaged, but the front door bulged inward. Water dribbled around the frame. Rocky lifted his head, suddenly afraid not to look. He whimpered as he peered at the wild river, at the low concrete ceiling, and at the rectangle of cheerless gray stormlight beyond the bridge. "Hell," Spencer said. "Pee on the seat if you want to." The truck sank into another swale. They were 2/3 of the way through the tunnel. A hissing, needle-thin stream of water squirted through a tiny breach in the twisted doorframe. Rocky yelped as it spattered him. When the truck soared out of the trough, it wasn't thrown into the columns after all. Worse, the river heaved as if passing over an enormous obstruction on the floor of the wash, and it slammed the explorer straight up into the low concrete underside of the bridge. Braced with both hands on the steering wheel, determined not to be thrown into the side window, Spencer was unprepared for the upward rush. He dropped in his seat as the roof crumpled inward, but he was not quick enough. The ceiling cracked against the top of his skull. Bright bolts of pain flashed behind his eyes, along his spine. Blood streamed down his face, scalding tears, his vision blurred. The river carried the truck down from the underside of the bridge, and Spencer tried to push up in his seat. The effort made him dizzy, so he slumped again, breathing hard. His tears swiftly darkened as if polluted. His blurred vision faded. Soon the tears were as black as ink, and he was blind. The prospect of blindness panicked him, and panicked opened a door to understanding. He wasn't blind, thank God, but he was passing out. He held desperately to consciousness. If he fainted, he might never wake. He balanced on the edge of a swoon. Then hundreds of gray dots appeared in the blackness, expanded into elaborate matrices of light and shadow until he could see the interior of the truck. Pulling himself up in the seat as far as the crumpled roof would allow, he again almost passed out. Gingerly, he touched his bleeding scalp. The wound seeped rather than gushed, not a mortal laceration. They were in the open once more. Rain hammered on the truck. The battery wasn't dead yet. Wipers still swept the windshield.
The explorer gamely wallowed down the center of the river, which was broader than ever, perhaps 120 feet wide, brimming against its banks, within inches of spilling over. God knew how deep it might be. The water was calmer than it had been, but moving fast. Gazing worriedly at the liquid road ahead, Rocky made pitiful sounds of distress. He wasn't bobbing his head, wasn't delighted by their speed as on the streets of Vegas. He didn't seem to trust nature as much as he had trusted his master.
"Good old Mr. Rocky Dog,"
Spencer said affectionately, and was unnerved to hear that his speech was slurred. In spite of Rocky's concern, Spencer couldn't see any unusual dangers immediately ahead, nothing like the bridge. For a couple of miles, the flow appeared to proceed unimpeded until it vanished into rain, mist, and the iron-colored light of thunderhead-filtered sun. Desert plains lay on both sides, bleak but not entirely barren. Mesquite bristled, clumps of wiry grass. Outcroppings of gnarled rock also grew out of the plains. They were natural formations, but achieved the strange geometry of ancient druid structures. A new pain blossomed in Spencer's skull. Irresistible darkness flowered behind his eyes. He might have been out for a minute or an hour. He didn't dream. He just went away into a timeless dark. When he revived, cool air fluttered feebly across his brow, and cold rain spattered his face. The many liquid voices of the river grumbled, hissed, and chuckled louder than before. He sat for a while, wondering why the sound was so much louder. His thoughts were muddled. Eventually, he realized that the side window had collapsed while he'd been unconscious. Gummy laces of highly fragmented tempered glass lay in his lap. Water was ankle-deep on the floor. His feet were half-numb with cold. He propped them on the brake pedal and flexed his toes in his saturated shoes. The explorer was riding lower than when last he'd noticed. The water was only an inch below the bottom of the window. Though moving fast, the river was less turbulent, perhaps because it had broadened. If the arroyo narrowed or the terrain changed, the flow might become tempestuous again, lap inside and sink them. Spencer was barely clear-headed enough to know that he should be alarmed. Nevertheless, he could muster only a mild concern. He should find a way to seal the dangerous gap where the window had been, but the problem seemed insurmountable. For one thing, he would have had to move to accomplish it, and he didn't want to move. All he wanted to do was sleep. He was so tired, exhausted. His head lolled to the right against the headrest, and he saw the dog sitting on the passenger seat. "How you doing, Furbutt?" he asked thickly, as if he'd been pouring down beer after beer. Rocky glanced at him, then looked again at the river ahead.
"Don't be afraid, pal. He wins if you're afraid. Don't let the master win. Can't let him win. Gotta find Valerie before he does. He's out there. He's forever on the prowl."
With the woman on his mind and a deep uneasiness in his heart, Spencer Grant rode through the glistening day, muttering feverishly, searching for something unknown, unknowable. The vigilant dog sat silently beside him. Rain ticked on the crumpled roof of the truck. Maybe he passed out again, maybe he only closed his eyes, but when his feet slipped off the brake pedal and splashed into water that was now halfway up his calves, Spencer lifted his throbbing head and saw that the windshield wipers had stopped. Dead battery. The river was as fast as an express train. Some turbulence had returned. Muddy water licked at the sill of the broken window. Inches beyond that gap, a dead rat floated on the surface of the flow, pacing the truck, long and sleek, one unblinking glassy eye fixed on Spencer, lips skinned back from sharp teeth. The long, disgusting tail was as stiff as wire, strangely curled and kinked. The sight of the rat alarmed Spencer as he had not been alarmed by the flood lapping at the windowsill. With the breathless, heart-pounding fear familiar from nightmares, he knew he would die if the rat washed into the truck, because it was not merely a rat, it was death. It was a cry in the night and the hoot of an owl, a flashing blade and the smell of hot blood. It was the catacombs, it was the smell of lime. And worse, it was the door out of boyhood innocence, the passageway to hell, the room at the end of nowhere. It was all that in the cold flesh of one dead rodent. If it touched him, he'd scream until his lungs burst and his last breath would be darkness. If only he could find an object with which to reach through the window and shove the thing away without having to touch it directly. But he was too weak to search for anything that could serve as a prod. His hands lay in his lap, palms up, and even contracting his fingers into fists required more strength than he possessed. Maybe more damage had been done than he had first realized when the top of his head had hit the ceiling. He wondered if paralysis had begun to creep through him. If so, he wondered if it mattered.
Lightning scarred the sky. A bright reflection transformed the rat's tenebrous eye into a flaring white orb that seemed to swivel in the socket to glare even more directly at Spencer. He sensed that his fixation on the rat would draw it toward him, that his horrified gaze was a magnet to its iron-black eye. He looked away from it, ahead, at the river. Though he was sweating profusely, he was colder than ever. Even his scar was cold, not ablaze any longer. The coldest part of him. His skin was ice, but his scar was frozen steel. Blinking away the rain as it slanted through the window, Spencer watched the river gain speed, racing toward the only interesting feature in an otherwise tedious landscape of gently declining plains. North to south, across the Mojave, vanishing in mist, a spine of rock jutted as high as 20 or 30 feet in some places, as low as 3 feet in others. Though it was a natural geological feature, the formation was weathered curiously, with wind-carved windows, and appeared to be the ruined ramparts of an immense fortification, erected and destroyed in a warring age 1,000 years prior to recorded history. Along some of the highest portions of the expanse were suggestions of crumbling and unevenly crenellated parapets. In places, the wall was breached from top to bottom, as though an enemy army had battered into the fortress at those points. Spencer concentrated on the fantasy of the ancient castle, superimposing it upon the escarpment of stone to distract himself from the dead rat floating just beyond the broken window at his side. In his mental confusion, he was not initially concerned that the river was carrying him toward those battlements. Gradually, however, he realized that the approaching encounter might be as devastating to the truck as had been the brutal game of pinball with the bridge. If the currents conveyed the explorer through one of the sluiceways and along the river, the queer rock formations would be just interesting scenery. But if the truck clipped one of those natural gateposts, the spine of rock traversed the arroyo, but was breached in 3 places by the flow. The widest gap was 50 feet across and lay to the right, framed by the south shore and by a 6-foot-wide, 20-foot-high tower of dark stone that rose from the water. The narrowest passage, not even 8 feet wide, lay in the center, between that first tower and another pile of rocks 10 feet wide and 12 high. Between that pile and the left-hand shore, where the battlements soared again and ran uninterrupted far to the north, lay the third passage, which must have been between 20 and 30 feet across. "Gonna make it," he tried to reach out to the dog, couldn't. With 100 yards to go, the explorer seemed to be drifting swiftly toward the southernmost and widest gateway. Spencer wasn't able to stop himself from glancing to the left, through the missing window, at the rat, floating, closer than before. The stiff tail was mottled pink and black. A memory scuttled through his mind. Rats in a cramped place, hateful red eyes in the shadows, rats in the catacombs, down in the catacombs, and ahead lies the room at the end of nowhere. With a quiver of revulsion, he looked forward. The windshield was blurred by rain. Nevertheless, he could see too much. Having closed within 50 yards of the point at which the river divided, the truck no longer sailed toward the widest passage. It angled left toward the center gate, the most dangerous of the three. The channel narrowed. The water accelerated. "Hold on, pal. Hold on." Spencer hoped to be carried sharply to the left, past the center gate, into the north passage. 20 yards from the sluiceways, the lateral drift of the truck slowed. It would never reach the north gate. It was going to race through the center. 15 yards. 10. Even to transit the center passage, they would need some luck. At the moment, they were rocketing toward the 20-foot-high gatepost of solid rock on the right of that opening. Maybe they would just graze the pillar or even slide by with a finger's width to spare. They were so close that Spencer could no longer see the base of the stone tower past the front of the explorer. Please, God. The bumper rammed the rock as though to cleave it. The impact was so great that Rocky slid onto the floor again. The right front fender tore loose, flew away. The hood buckled as if made of tinfoil. The windshield imploded, but instead of spraying Spencer, tempered glass cascaded over the dashboard in glutinous, prickly wads. For an instant after the collision, the explorer was at a dead stop in the water, and at an angle to the direction of the flow. Then the raging current caught the side of the truck and began to push the back end around to the left. Spencer opened his eyes and watched in disbelief as the explorer turned crosswise to the flow. It could never pass sideways between the two masses of rock and through the center sluiceway. The gap was too narrow. The truck would wedge tight. Then the rampaging river would hammer the passenger side until it flooded the interior, or maybe hurled a driftwood log through the open window at his head.
Shuddering, grinding, the front of the explorer worked along the rock deeper into the passage, and the back end continued to arc to the left. The river pushed hard on the passenger side, surging halfway up the windows. In turn, as the driver's side of the truck was shoved fully around toward the narrow sluiceway, it created a small swell that rose over the windowsill. The back end slammed into the second gatepost, and water poured inside onto Spencer, carrying the dead rodent which had remained in the orbit of the truck. The rat slipped greasily through his upturned palms and onto the seat between his legs. Its stiff tail trailed across his right hand. The catacombs, the fiery eyes watching from the shadows. The room at the end of nowhere. He tried to scream, but what he heard was a choked and broken sobbing like that of a child, terrified beyond endurance. Possibly half paralyzed from the blow to his head, without a doubt paralyzed by fear, he still managed a spasmodic twitch of both hands, casting the rat off the seat. It splashed into a calf-deep pool of muddy water on the floor. Now it was out of sight, but not gone, down there, floating between his legs. Don't think about that. He was as dizzy as if he had spent hours on a carousel, and a funhouse darkness was bleeding into the edges of his vision. He wasn't sobbing anymore. He repeated the same two words in a hoarse, agonized voice. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. In his deepening delirium, he knew that he was not apologizing to the dog, or to Valerie Keene, whom he would now never save, but to his mother for not having saved her, either. She had been dead for more than 22 years. He had been only 8 years old when she died, too small to have saved her, too small then to feel such enormous guilt now. Yet, I'm sorry, spilled from his lips. The river industriously shoved the explorer deeper into the sluiceway, although the truck was now entirely crosswise to the flow. Both front and rear bumpers scraped and rattled along the rock walls. The tortured Ford squealed, groaned, creaked. It was at most 1 inch shorter from back to front than the width of the water-smooth gap through which it was struggling to be borne. The river wiggled it, wrenched it, alternately jammed and finessed it, crumpled it at each end to force it forward a foot, an inch, grudgingly forward. Simultaneously, gradually, the tremendous power of the thwarted currents actually lifted the truck a foot. The dark water surged against the passenger side, no longer halfway up the windows on that flank, but swirling at the base of them. Rocky remained down in the half-flooded leg space, enduring. When Spencer had quelled his dizziness with sheer willpower, he saw that the spine of rock bisecting the arroyo was not as thick as he had thought. From the entrance to the exit of the sluiceway, that corridor of stone would measure no more than 12 feet. The jackhammering river pushed the explorer 9 feet into the passage, and then, with a streak of tearing metal and an ugly binding sound, the truck wedged tight. If it had made only 3 more feet, the explorer would have flowed with the river once more, clear and free. So close. Now that the truck was held fast, no longer protesting the grip of the rock, the rain was again the loudest sound in the day. It was more thunderous than before, although falling no harder. Maybe it only seemed louder because he was sick to death of it. Rocky had scrambled onto the seat again, out of the water on the floor, dripping and miserable. I'm so sorry, Spencer said. Fending off despair and the insistent darkness that constricted his vision, incapable of meeting the dog's trusting eyes, Spencer turned to the side window, to the river, which so recently he had feared and hated, but which he now longed to embrace. The river wasn't there. He thought he was hallucinating. Far away, veiled by furies of rain, a range of desert mountains defined the horizon, and the highest elevations were lost in clouds. No river dwindled from him toward those distant peaks. In fact, nothing whatsoever seemed to lie between the truck and the mountains. The vista was like a painting in which the artist had left the foreground of the canvas entirely blank. Then, almost dreamily, Spencer realized that he had not seen what was there to see. His perception had been hampered as much by his expectations as by his befuddled senses. The canvas wasn't blank, after all. Spencer needed only to alter his point of view, lower his gaze from his own plane, to see the 1,000-foot chasm into which the river plunged. The miles-long spine of weathered rock that he had thought marched across otherwise flat desert terrain was actually the irregular parapet of a perilous cliff. On his side, the sandy plain had eroded over eons to a somewhat lower level than the rock. On the other side was not another plain, but a sheer face of stone down which the river fell with a cataclysmic roar.
He had also wrongly assumed that the increased rumble of rain was imaginary. In fact, the greater roar was a trio of waterfalls, altogether more than 100 feet across, crashing 100 stories to the valley floor below. Spencer couldn't see the foaming cataracts because the explorer was suspended directly over them. He lacked the strength to pull himself against the door and lean out the window to look. With the flood pushing hard against the passenger side, as well as slipping under it and away, the truck actually hung half in the narrowest of the three falls, prevented from being carried over the brink only by the jaws of the rock vise. He wondered how in God's name he was going to get out of the truck and out of the river alive. Then he rejected all consideration of the challenge. The fearfulness of it sapped what meager energy he still had. He must rest first, think later. From where Spencer slumped in the driver's seat, though he had no view of the river gone vertical, he could see the broad valley beneath him and the serpentine course of the water as it flowed horizontally again across the lower land. That long drop and the tilted panorama at the bottom caused a new attack of vertigo, and he turned away to avoid passing out. Too late. The motion of a phantom carousel afflicted him, and the spinning view of rock and rain became a tight spiral of darkness into which he tumbled, around and around, and down and away. And there in the night behind the barn, I'm still spooked by the swooping angel that was only an owl. Inexplicably, when the vision of my mother in celestial robes and wings proves to be a fantasy, I am overcome by another image of her. Bloody, crumpled, naked, dead in a ditch 80 miles from home, as she had been found 6 years before. I never actually saw her that way, not even in a newspaper photograph, only heard the scene described by a few kids in school, vicious little bastards. Yet after the owl has vanished into the moonlight, I can't retain the vision of an angel, though I try, and I can't shed the gruesome mental picture of the battered corpse, although both images are products of my imagination and should be subject to my control. Bare-chested and barefoot, I move farther behind the barn, which hasn't been a real working barn for more than 15 years. It's a well-known place to me, part of my life since I can remember. Yet tonight it seems different from the barn I've always known, changed in some way that I can't define, but that makes me uneasy. It's a strange night, stranger than I yet realize, and I'm a strange boy, full of questions I'd never dared to ask myself, seeking answers in that July darkness, when the answers are within me, if I would only look for them there. I'm a strange boy who feels the warp in the wood of life gone wrong, but who convinces himself that the warped line is really true and straight. I'm a strange boy who keeps secrets from himself, and keeps them as well as the world keeps the secret of its meaning. In the eerily quiet night behind the barn, I creep cautiously toward the Chevy van, which I've never seen before. No one is behind the wheel or in the other front seat. When I place my hand on the hood, it's warm with engine heat. The metal is still cooling with faint ticks and pings. I slip past the rainbow mural on the side of the van to the open rear door. Although the interior of the cargo section is dark, enough pale moonlight filters back from the windshield to reveal that no one is in there either. I am also able to see that it is only a 2-seater with no apparent amenities, though the customized exterior led me to expect a plush recreational vehicle. I still sense there's something ominous about the van, other than the simple fact that it doesn't belong here. Seeking a reason for that ominousness, leaning through the open door, squinting, wishing I'd brought a flashlight, I'm hit by the stink of urine. Someone has pissed in the back of the van. Weird. Jesus. Of course, maybe it's only a dog that made the mess, which isn't so weird after all, but it's still disgusting. Holding my breath, wrinkling my nose, I step back from the door and hunker down to get a closer look at the license plate. It's from Colorado, not out of state. I stand. I listen. Silence. The barn waits. Like many barns built in snow country, it had been essentially windowless when constructed. Even after the radical conversion of the interior, the only windows are 2 on the first floor, the south side, and 4 second-floor panes in this face. Those 4 above me are tall and wide to capture the north light from dawn to dusk. The windows are dark. The barn is silent.